Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Florida State University chapter of SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, joined this edition of 411 Teen. Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, is a pro-Palestinian college activism organization. It's committed to ending Israel's occupation and colonialization of all Arab land. It has advocated and campaigned for boycott and divestment against Israel and opposes war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. The organization was first established at the University of California, Berkeley, in 1993. SJP calls for respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in the United Nations Assembly Resolution. There are over 93 chapters nationwide. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome Shelby Shoup. Shelby is a student at Florida State, a junior majoring in social science education. Her interests include reading, drawing, and community organization.
Hey, y'all. I'm excited to be here.
Well, thank you for coming. Brian Singerlin. Brian is the director of operations, The Plant. His interests are political prisoner solidarity. Hello.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Holyfield.
Thanks for coming. Reem Zaitoun is an FSU student. Her major is international affairs, and she's president of SJP.
Hi, everyone.
Nada Zaitoun is also a student at FSU. She is a sophomore. Her major is anthropology and international affairs, and her things are film, SJP, and reading.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Holyfield.
Well, thanks for coming. Educate us about SJP, because I really don't think that people know who and what you are about. So I know we all know the origin. I said already it started at the University of California in Berkeley, 1993. But tell us about it. What is it about? And I'll just start with whomever, and we'll go around the table.
So the Students for Justice in Palestine organization has, like you said, nationwide chapters. We all work together as students, in the hopes of educating people and mobilizing our campuses, our faculty, our students, in order to, like I said, educate about the Palestinian liberation and the Palestinian struggle, but also to organize alongside other struggles and other organizations that are in our areas. Like, for example, we do organizing with political prisoners, as well as black liberation, trans and women's rights. We're not just, we are a Palestinian organization, mm-hmm. but that does not mean that we don't exclude or that we don't link arms with other struggles that happen to be in our areas as well. So,
okay. Other comments, mm-hmm. additions?
Yeah. Like what Reem said, it does focus on Palestine, but it is also about working with other liberation struggles and helping other oppressed peoples understand that we're all under the same system of oppression.
Okay.
And it's important to point out that our chapter has been around for maybe like 6 years, okay. and we've always like focused on that struggle, also indigenous rights. Mm. We're anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist. Like, so everything that we do, we try to reflect that.
Okay. All right. What about the PSM, the Palestinian Solidarity Movement? And do you have a direct relationship with that, or how does that work? And I throw that out to everyone. I mean, whoever wants to respond. I mean,
I think just being a person or a human, I think you do already have a relationship to it. I don't think it takes a Palestinian or a marginalized person at all to have anything to do with the Palestinian liberation. It includes everyone, and it involves everyone, And it should involve and include everyone, because this liberation struggle is communal. It's for everyone. It's by everyone. And ultimately, it will serve the entire world. Like, a free Palestine won't exist without the dismantling of imperialism and apartheid and colonialism across all nations, all communities, everywhere. So, with regards to direct relations, you just have to be a human being.
Yeah. So. And solidarity isn't just reacting to events that happen or atrocities that you see. It's a constant engaging in the liberation struggle. That's real solidarity.
Okay.
I think it's really cool to see now more than ever a lot of organizations that focus on Palestinian solidarity or are incorporating Palestinian solidarity into their demands, into their platforms, whether it be, you know, Black Lives Matter, the organization, which has in their policy platform support for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, whether it's Jewish organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace or If Not Now that are against the occupation or apartheid or both. And like Reem said earlier, seeing that solidarity on campus and seeing different organizations and different representatives from across Florida State and across the Tallahassee community showing up for Palestine, whether it's at rallies or educational programs, is really inspiring. And all kind of falls under that umbrella of collective liberation.
It's important to recognize that the oppressors are pretty much the same. They're hand in hand and they work together to, like, you know, keep a tight, systematic oppression going. So when everybody struggling for liberation recognizes that and works together, it's really
And you all have mentioned that there seems to be solidarity. You have more and more organizations that are working together, even on campus. What do you think? Why is that happening? I mean, that's good. That's a positive thing, you know, that you are working together. And to hear that is reassuring, that the efforts continue. Why do you see other organizations coming together? What's your opinion about that?
I love that you brought that up, honestly, because it can't not include everyone. We can't do it without the help and without the mobilization and energies of everyone else around us. It just it reminds me of a quote that one of our revolutionaries said, De La Khaled. She said that so long as our imperialists globalize their systems, we will globalize ours. And that's what we're doing when we work together as organizations together. We are globalizing a system to dismantle theirs that continues to oppress us. And like what Brian said, it's just one continuing thread. Our oppressors work together to be successful and to hurt us and to oppress us and to make our lives really difficult and miserable. So long as they work together, we need to do the same, and we need to defeat them at their own games. And so I think that's why it's so successful, and it's so especially beneficial when organizations reach out to one another and sincerely want to uplift each other's movements and each other's causes. That's what we're all here for. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not here just for Palestine. We're we're here for everything and everyone. So, yeah.
I think it relates a lot to Kimberly Crenshaw's theory of intersectionality. So intersectionality has sort of become this buzzword lately, yeah. And it's very often misused to refer to identities. You know, there will be people saying, oh, I'm an intersectional feminist. That's not what intersectionality is. What it is exploring the ways the different systems of oppression are connected and how that they work together to co-construct our experiences. And so when you have the intersection or, you know, apartheid ranging from South Africa to Palestine to the Jim Crow South, and understanding the ways that womanhood is constructed with reproductive rights, you know, when you have women who are denied abortion services in the U.S. or Ireland, thankfully no longer, or Palestinian women who are giving birth at checkpoint because they cannot move freely in their own homeland. It shows how crucial intersectionality is in understanding Palestinian liberation. And I think that the more that people realize that, the more people realize that the systems that oppress us construct our identities in a way that forces us to help each other, forces us to have to work together for our collective liberation, more and more individuals and organizations are getting involved with Palestinian liberation, which I think is incredible.
Both of what Reem and Shelby said reminds me also of another revolutionary for Palestine. He was Hassan Kanafani, who was kind of led the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, he made an analogy for the whole, like, global imperialism. It has a neck. They've imperialized in the east. It has limbs. It has feet, a torso. Mm-hmm. If you destroy it in one area of the world, it's not over. You've only got the hand, or you've only got an arm. It has to, like, be overcome everywhere for it to truly end.
Okay. You know, when we talk about what's happening in the world, the American media tends to cover many of the events in Israel. However, the status of the Palestinians and Palestinian territory, it's really very difficult to determine. I mean, if one is interested, they have to really search, you know. They have to really, at least I think so from what I've found, I have to really search to try to determine what is actually happening. From your perspective, and I know you may not be able to finish because we're going to need to take a break, but what are the issues that you see, and how are they related to Palestine? What are the issues overall that are going on?
It's fun.
I mean, I was just going to say, you talked about oppression, and yes, mm-hmm. oppression is everyone, but would you elaborate? Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it's funny that, not funny in a funny
not
way,
funny.
But
yeah.
funny that the sort of an Israeli tactic is to make the apartheid system as complicated as possible to dissuade people from doing that research. But really, the core of the issue is pretty simple to understand. It's an instance of settler colonialism. It's an instance of apartheid. Things that we have seen across, you know, time and space, things that we see in our own nation as mm-hmm. we are also a settler colony. And because of that colonial violence, that includes reproductive violence, and it very much includes imprisonment. So obviously prison abolition is huge in the realm of Palestinian liberation. Really, if there's an issue that you care about, whether it's racial justice, like reproductive justice, you can find it in Palestine. You can find an avenue for it in Palestine. It's pretty clear cut that Israel is the oppressor. Palestine is the oppressed. But the Israeli apartheid system very intentionally tries to make it seem convoluted with the sectioning of the West Bank.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with SJP. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and Shelby, I had to interrupt you, but you had some really powerful statements and some very informative statements that you were sharing, so you want to continue what you were saying.
Basically, to wrap up, you know, Angela Davis talks about it in her more recent book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, about how when she meets people who are interested in getting involved with the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, the thing that she hears most often is that there's so much history, it's too much for me to understand, or I don't even know where to look, or I'm not sure what's biased and what's not. But really, again, like I said, the Israeli apartheid system is intentionally convoluted. The Israeli government designs it to be intentionally convoluted to dissuade people from getting involved. Mm-hmm. But the root issues of racial violence, of colonial violence, of imprisonment, of women's rights, of, you know, LGBTQ plus solidarity, they're, once you understand them in the context of the United States or wherever you live, you can understand them in the context of Palestine or in the context of global solidarity. So... Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like what Shelby said, they purposely make it very, very hard to learn about, like throwing in concepts of their exile from 2,000 years ago, making it much harder for people to even want to pursue learning about it, or throwing in Hamas or whatever else they want to throw in. It makes it very hard to approach.
Although it is hard, and like I completely agree, and it's a struggle with media and what Israel does with Zionist propaganda to just completely erase and silence us. And actually, very recently in the news, they're trying to pass this bill to imprison Palestinians who pull out a phone or a camera to film any IDF, you know, violence that goes down in the West Bank, 5 years minimum is the, like, the sentence they're giving out. So when you see all these, everything, the pushback that we're up against, yes, it is very difficult to reach the truth, but that doesn't mean it's not out there. It mm-hmm. is 100% out there, because every single Palestinian is on their phone or on, you know, releasing something. Some kind of a news piece is being released every single day. Two in particular that always have the truth is called, one of them is the Quds News Network, which is spelled QUDS, and then the other one is the IMEU. Those are the two, like, best sources to use. They're on Facebook and Twitter. Always follow those. And then Palestinians are always pumping out information on social media. We utilize social media because it's central to our revolution and to our movement. So whenever people tell me it's difficult, yes, it is. I understand that, but that doesn't mean you can't keep trying. You have to keep trying to find the truth.
You anticipated my questions, because my next thing was going to be, well, what are the resources? Where can one go for the folks who are listening, you know, that may want more information? So I really appreciate you sharing that. Okay. Any comments from you, Brian?
I mean, I think your question was about the media and how, you know,
okay.
it's portrayed here. And it's important to recognize that the media has its own agenda, and, you know, the government here has its own agenda and doesn't want to talk about the ethnically cleansing indigenous people, which is what's happening to the Palestinians right
now.
Well,
if we don't talk about it, then that means it's not happening. Right. No, but that's what programs like this are about, you know, to educate folks and let them know what's going on, what's out there, what you all as students are doing. So I really appreciate you coming just to share with us and to educate us about what is happening. As far as the Palestinians, do they have any autonomy?
The Palestinians in Palestine,
it's
very hard to mobilize. They're very silenced, and obviously, if anyone has kept up with Ahed Tamimi, the young 18-year-old who's still in prison, there's many more children political prisoners in Palestine. Like, that's a fear they face. They make it very terrifying, and if not that, even when you see in Gaza them going out to the border, they purposefully target children to kill. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of being silenced or being stigmatized. It's a matter of life or death sometimes.
I mean, it just seems like that Palestinians have no ultimate power over their lives. Like, they have absolutely no control. They have no nation. They have no citizenship. They live in oppression in the West Bank. I mean, that's, at least from my perspective, you know, how it looks. I'm just wondering, is that an accurate perspective?
No, it is completely accurate.
Oh, okay.
Palestinians in the West Bank, even, yes, like, you might have a job, you might be able to go to school,
mm-hmm.
but occupation and apartheid permeates every aspect of their lives. When you're sitting in your house, electricity might cut out, the water might cut out, because that is 100% controlled by the Israeli government. Occupation is felt in our very homes, in, like, in every aspect of life. They show up late to work because they got stuck at a checkpoint. A mother is stuck to give birth at a checkpoint with Zionist IDF soldiers videotaping giving birth at the checkpoint. It's just that every single aspect of our lives is controlled down to the T. And when you look at Gaza, which is a completely different situation than the West Bank, it's unlivable.
Yeah,
it is
my husband was there.
Yeah, it's absolutely unlivable. Yeah. And youth unemployment is up to 60%. 90% of the water is undrinkable.
I know he was saying to me that health care is really non-existent. You know, that you don't have health care. But it's not only health care. It's education. It's the whole infrastructure. It's the policies. It just seems to be, you know, everything. So, and I ask that, you know, for the listening audience, because that's the way that I see it, and I just want to make sure that my perception is accurate.
Something I actually learned from Reem was that in Gaza, where, you know, Israel has the Gaza Strip under blockade, and like Reem said, it is completely uninhabitable there. It is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. The UN projects it to be actually uninhabitable by 2020, that Israel controls the caloric intake of the Palestinians in Gaza.
Really?
The occupying government controls Palestinian lives and denies them agency to the point where Israel controls the calories that they are eating in a single day. And if that's not, you know, just monstrous to you, I don't know what else could, you know, elicit empathy from someone.
It's definitely torture and collective punishment. The siege on Gaza, it's air, land, and sea. Mm-hmm. They control the imports, right, down to the calorie, and electricity maybe 2 hours a day in some areas, and mm-hmm. water for only like a couple hours a day in some areas. And yeah, the rest of the water, 90% of it's undrinkable.
Gazans can't even leave. Like, they are trapped in this strip, and they're not even allowed permission to remove their bodies from this situation. Like, even granting the right to go outside and live and breathe is not permissible by the Israeli government. It is deemed the largest open-air prison in the world. And all these statistics, like, we can pound out every single torturous, just horrific living condition that every single Palestinian has to endure in Palestine, and still we are faced with tremendous backlash and pushback from the Zionists, from the government there, and it's just, it's easy to lose hope, but that is why it's especially important for the international community to stand in solidarity and to continue organizing for the Palestinian movement.
But like, according to international law, an occupying force is responsible for the protection of the civilian population that's living under its control.
Correct.
Yeah, but when have you ever seen Israel stand by any law that it has even produced? When have we ever seen Israel abide by any UN resolution ever?
I mean, Israel
we don't expect it to.
Is illegally existing.
Exactly.
Under
exactly.
international law.
It has no right to exist. We don't expect it to pass any law and to follow it. We don't expect it to abide by any resolution passed by the UN or any organization for that matter. It is up to us, the Palestinian people. It is up to the international community to stand alongside us to finally deliver justice and finally bring the Palestinians home. Because it was never up to the Zionists.
Okay. Recently, Nikki Haley walked out of negotiations. What, if anything, does this indicate? What message
that
does this walk out?
That the United States is 100% complicit in the genocide of Palestinians. She signed off on genocide. The University of Houston recently organized against her presence there, and they walked out on her because she walked out on the Palestinians. And it just shows you that the United States and Israel are the same thing. They work together to oppress the Palestinian people. It comes as no surprise that she did that. Mm-hmm. It comes as no surprise to us that any of this happens, but regarding it, I guess the only thing we could do is commend the Houston organizers for staging such a big disruption against her. And it also goes to testify that anytime someone like that shows up on our campuses or in our communities, we do everything we can to make sure that they are not welcome there. And that their presence is not allowed so long as they sign off on the genocide of our people.
I think that it sends a message very loud and clear to all the Zionists and Zionist sympathizers who rely on these frankly racist tropes of Arab savagery and claim, you know, the Arabs don't want peace, Palestinians don't want peace, that Nikki Haley would not even listen to what the Palestinian envoy to the UN would have to say. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. had no interest in even talking about what is happening in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is a message loud and clear that it's not the Palestinians that don't want peace. It's not the Arabs that don't want peace. The United States doesn't want peace. And this has been proven time and time again that, you know, the two-state solution is effectively dead. And apartheid is actually more profitable for Israel and, by extension, the United States. So staying in this limbo of apartheid, of occupation, is actually what is most beneficial for the United States and its client state, Israel.
That's absolutely true. This is all literally just one big business to them. Mm-hmm. Like, the theft of our people's land is
not
just,
to interrupt you, but it's always about money.
Right.
It's very
lucrative. I mean, you know, I mean, no matter where you are, United States, Israel, Palestine, South Africa, France, I mean, that's, you know, that lean dollar green,
right.
That's what it's about.
And that's why the Palestinian movement, yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, because we are an anti-capitalist movement. And so long as the system of capitalism persists and so long as it thrives, we won't achieve liberation. So the battle is not only delivering our people home, but also dismantling this capitalist, colonialist, imperialist state that continues to thrive off of the murder and the oppression of every single black and brown person in the world, not just this country or Thailand or Philippines, everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. We have to dismantle this entire system.
Well, living under these hardships is what led to the Intifada. Mm-hmm. Talk about the Intifada, because it's rarely addressed in the American media. And I, you know, would like to have you talk about the uprising, the rebellion. It's like the American Revolutionary War, you know. So would you just kind of give my listening audience an overview of what it is and what it was about?
The Intifada was our right. It is our right and a means to survival, armed resistance, and, you know, revolting in the ways that the Intifada was. It is our right, and it is a reaction. It is a complete reaction to decades of oppression and apartheid and theft and death, murder. So when the Intifada happened, the Palestinians, of course, uplifted it and supported it, because it was finally, like, a tangible material mobilization that we could see in front of our eyes. We were like, our people were finally, like, we had arms, we had a way in which to maybe hopefully dismantle our oppressors. So when we talk about the Intifada, when we see it in the media as well, it's in any negative or, you know, condemning context. No, we need to take that out, because we have a right to armed resistance. We have a right to revolution. It is inherently our right to achieve that and to acquire that. So, yes, Third Intifada, let's go.
And often people want to say, like, you lose legitimacy when, like, you're violent. But if you look at what they're going through, like, the violence is like asymmetrical warfare against a controlled civilian population. So what mm-hmm. are people supposed to do? Until you're there and living, like, in those conditions, I think people shouldn't even be critical of what right. form of resistance they choose to take.
Yeah, it's really, I suppose it can be on an individual level, whether you consider freedom fighters to be terrorists or not, whether an armed struggle and taking up arms as a form of resistance, if you even want to label that as terrorism in any sort of way, when it's the oppressed fighting against their oppressor.
It's funny. I actually watched a movie at my synagogue once a few years ago. And if you couldn't guess, I'm Jewish, and
you belong to SJP.
And I belong to SJP.
She does.
Okay. All right.
And I grew up in a very, you know, Zionist synagogue, albeit anti-Zionist family. And we watched a movie once, and it was about the Shin Bet, who are like the special ops of the IDF. And I remember so clearly in that movie, one of the Shin Bet officers said something to the effect of, well, you know, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, and was talking in response, or, you know, about Palestinians. And, you know, at the time I was like, oh, what good sound, you know, logic, seeing both sides of the picture, until I grew older, went to college, became more radicalized, became totally supportive of the one-state solution, and I realized, well, one man's freedom fighter is correct. They are literally fighting for freedom. It is completely justified to take whatever action. And if you do need, you know, international law to, you know, back that up, 1982, the UN General Assembly ruled in the wake of Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon that occupied people have the right to resist, including armed resistance. And honestly, at the end of the day, when you're up against the world's most technologically advanced military, which has billions of dollars of funding from the United States, you know, you can call Palestinians terrorists all you want, but at the end of the day, like, if someone has a rock versus if they have a tank, who do you think is really exerting more violence in that situation? And I guess it also relates to the redefinition of violence. It's not just physical. It's, you know, colonial violence, imprisonment as a form of violence. And I think that people, especially in the imperial core, especially living in the United States, like Brian said, we don't really have a right to criticize how people choose to resist while we sit in our cushy armchairs and, you know, march every couple of months.
Like, do you think anybody would have called Native Americans terrorists for resisting, like, colonial powers?
Right.
Absolutely.
No.
Of course not.
No, not at all. What is the BDS?
Good one.
The boycott, divestment, sanctions.
Yeah,
It's exactly what it sounds like, but it's targeted towards Israel, or rather against Israel. It's just divesting from and boycotting companies and brands that are either produced in Israel or have huge headquarters. Anything that Israel profits from, corporation-wise or brand-wise. So it could be little companies like Coca-Cola or like Sabra Hummus to like HP and Caterpillar,
L'Oreal.
The tractor.
Okay. L'Oreal.
You're tuned into 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen has students from SJP, and I'm very glad to have them. I welcome them again. Shelby Shoup, Brian Slingerland, Reem Zaitoun, Nada Zaitoun. I had to interrupt you. You were really talking about BDS, and I'd like you all to continue.
Well, to recap, it's BDS is boycott, divestment, sanction from companies that allow Israel to profit off of their own profits. So, like I said, it's companies like Coca-Cola, HP, Caterpillar, L'Oreal, Sabra Hummus.
Adding on to that, BDS is... When it was first started, it was a laughingstock, honestly. The Israeli government were like, this is ridiculous. Like, there's nothing. There's no way it could ever grow into a real thing. And now it's such a threat to them that not only are they scared of it, but they are passing anti-BDS legislation across the United States to counteract any BDS movement that is happening with different companies and different owners of companies. So... when you look at BDS, it's extremely important to Palestinians because it gives us a base ground on which we can grow our organizing and where we can grow our movement. When we divest and when we boycott our oppressors, it shows them that we collectively, together, along with our international allies, we have a movement that can potentially overthrow them. I wanted to talk about, like, recently in this semester, we had a bunch of, like, anti-BDS things happen at the Capitol, in which it was Representative Moskowitz and Jared Fine. Yeah, I'm name-dropping because they know me.
Okay.
But, yeah, it was they... I mean, I went and, like, testified on behalf of Palestinians and behalf of SJP in general, and the comments that came out of that entire representative, like, room was tremendous. They were actually, like, frightened of my presence there and, like, the fact that Palestinians were organizing against anti-BDS sentiment. And they were like, I can't believe she's threatening us. This is terrorism. And yeah, it's
BDS
just...
BDS is economic terrorism.
Yeah. Oh, so right. It just shows you, like, how scared they are of our movement, but it is gaining strength and speed along the way.
Living under all these hardships is what led to the Intifada. A lot of people don't know what the Intifada is. Mm-hmm. They see Intifada and they think, I don't know what they think, but they don't know. I mean, it would be the same as like the American Revolutionary War to me.
It's an Arabic word, so it sounds scary to
me. Yeah. Would you just elaborate on that for a minute?
Okay. So there have been two Intifadas that mm-hmm. occurred. One, the 80s to 90s, and then another in the early 2000s. And so the Intifada, the first Intifada was based upon solely grassroots movement because and reactions actually when the Palestinian people decided and were fed up of being living under occupation, they turned to themselves and decided to organize protests, decided to get people to start going out, challenging Israeli structures of technology and military weaponry with rocks and stones. That's the kind of fight that the Palestinians have been pushing.
That's when they had that broken arm policy.
Absolutely.
When they were breaking folks' arms.
So okay. they were okay, breaking their arms. The IDF was breaking their arms and
they
can't throw stones mm-hmm. and put it, mm-hmm. sentencing them to 20 years in prison. Mm-hmm. And now in the second Intifada was a reaction to the failure of the international community to get Israel out of Palestine and stop the occupation that the Palestinians are enduring, into it was a reaction to the capitulation of the international law, of the international consensus, and ever since, after this Intifada, the Palestinians have been handicapped. There's all the popular fronts that were organizing. All these political leaders are now in prison, most of them, such as Marwan Barghouti, who was a crucial asset to like a lot of the organizing that was being done at the time. There were suicide bombings as well, and these people are considered martyrs in the Palestinian national memory for reasons that
are clear.
A person, to the extent that their psychological well-being has just been shot because mm-hmm. of all the occupation mm-hmm. and torment that was imposed upon them. So the only way that they think that they could receive agency in this world is by putting their physical and mortal lives to waste in order to gain immortal prestige among the Palestinians who see that as a form of resistance. And so it's important, you know, when we talk about Palestinian violence, that these forms of violence were the only means necessary which Palestinians resist in the face of the failure of all the world powers to be able to get Israel to abide by what the international consensus was, you know.
Well, thanks for sharing that. It's really important because I think a lot of people don't have an understanding for really what the Intifada is, and it sounds like, ooh, what does that mean? You know, just the sound of the word. But let's get into BDS in these last few minutes that we have. The movement works, I know, to end international support, basically, for Israel's oppression of Palestinians. And basically, I guess, to pressure Israel to follow or comply with the international law. You all elaborate on it. Talk to me.
Sure. So as I think Albert was discussing in regards to the Intifada, there are very few means, if any, that are considered legitimate as resistance to Israel occupation. Israel considers violent resistance to be illegitimate. Most of the international community does as well.
But that's all they do?
No. Israel does.
Israel,
yeah. Well,
does.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. However,
it's not. It's okay for
right.
them, but it's not.
Of
okay.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. It's okay to invade Gaza. Mm-hmm. It's okay to kill scores of children.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, no. So Palestinians obviously aren't afforded the kind of benefit of the doubt where that sort of resistance is concerned, which I think is unsurprising. However, what maybe should be surprising is that economic resistance is also not only by Israel, which would, I suppose, make sense, but in the United States, we have politicians, even in the state of Florida, who are pursuing policies to stigmatize or I don't know if I want to say criminalize, but disadvantage participants in the BDS movement. They view it, as we were talking about earlier, they view an economic boycott of the state of Israel, which I should mention, it's very much targeted, right? So BDS, which, by the way, stands for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. So this is to say this involves the boycott of products and of companies who are contributing to the Israeli occupation directly or indirectly, sanctioning the state by international actors, which is what really it's illegal actions based on international law call for anyway. And then again, divestment from those companies and from institutions in Israel such as the IDF that contribute or impose occupation.
And to backtrack even further, BDS, as you know, was the campaign that was responsible of ending apartheid in South Africa. And it's clearly an apartheid state, Israel-Palestine, and that we're hoping that the BDS movement obviously will have the same effect.
Do you think there's any real hope for a two-state solution? Okay.
No.
No.
I mean, I couldn't even get it out. But I mean,
oh my God.
Yeah, no, go for it. I mean, respond.
Hold on. Can I get something out regarding that? There is no two-state. There was one Palestine. Mm-hmm. There will be one Palestine. Whenever anyone, any liberal Zionist, any liberals anywhere, come forward and say, but why can't you just have why can't you just have peace? You can have a two-state, you can have peace. And it's like, what are we living in right now? Look at what the West Bank is. Look at what Gaza is. That's basically, when you look at it from the map, that's like two states.
That's
look
right.
at what that is doing to us. Mm-hmm. We are literally split up into areas A, B, and C, split up with apartheid walls. Gaza is Gaza. It's unlivable. And you just, what two-state solution? Like, it's humiliating. It's a slap in the face, and it's asking us to settle. And Palestinians were never a people that ever settled or ever stooped low to get half of what we wanted. No, we're getting our entire state back. We're not settling for no two or two, three state. There was never any such thing. And that's an invented notion by liberals and by Zionists to stifle us and to erase any desire for us to keep going, to keep fighting. We're getting one state.
Exactly. Two state was a smokescreen all along, because every time it'd be like peace talks, there'd be settlements, more settlements being built.
And they're building them more and more. Every time I pull up the news, it's about some settlement that's being built.
Yeah. It doesn't look like the oppressor wants peace.
No.
They don't.
What about the role of the UN? We haven't touched on that, so can we at least address that?
So, again, as we've talked about, Palestinian liberation is inherently anti-imperialist, and the two imperial forces that were most complicit, in my humble opinion, in the creation and sustaining of Israel are the United Kingdom and the United States, both of which are, vetoing members of the P5 of the Security Council. And really, at this point, the UN cannot realistically act on the Palestinian situation as long as the United States has the reins of the everything in the world. The UN is a nice thought, but the reality of imperialism is that the United States is currently acting as the judge, jury, and executioner for the entire world. And obviously that's not democratic. The world didn't vote on that. But such is the nature of a state rooted in violence that has 800 military bases in 800 worlds, that supplies weapons and money and aid to Israel, that as long as the United States is existing and with such power, with such immense imperial power, I don't think that the United Nations can realistically do anything more than release statements and resolutions, which Israel will continue to fail to abide by.
What about the, what impact does the moving of the U.S. Embassy, the relocation, have?
I mean, this happened on May 14th. Mm-hmm. That was the day before the Nakba, which is the what Israelis will celebrate as their Independence Day, but what Palestinians celebrate as, well, not celebrate, they commemorate every year as the catastrophe in 1948 when they were expelled by hundreds of thousands of them off of their land. So it was just a huge slap in the face from the Trump presidency, which I know we haven't touched on yet, but I know we will, but...
Yeah. I wanted to add really quickly, the United Nations was never for Palestine. It's, we call it the United Nothing. It never served the Palestinian people or our movement any good. When have you ever seen the UN step in and stop a settlement from happening? When did it stop a bulldozer from taking up another house? The UN is literally nothing to us. It hasn't ever served us. It has never helped us in any way. And so long as the United States exists and has vetoing power in the UN, like Shelby said, we don't get anything from it. The UN has never been an ally to us, and we don't rely on it. Like I said, again, our movement is Palestinian. It's for the Palestinians, and it's led by us. We never rely on any organization or any outside force that isn't an ally to help us move along the way. With the embassy moving, it was never about an embassy. Israel and the United States, hand in hand together, announced that Jerusalem now is the capital of Israel. Again, taking more historical land from us, another slap in the face, like Nada said, it's humiliating. And also, Jerusalem is completely Palestinian. It has always been. And the movement of this embassy is just, it just shows that our oppressors do work together. And Ivanka with her champagne and Trump with their, you know, they have their little photo op fiasco thing in Jerusalem. It's just, it's ridiculous.
Which leads into the Trump presidency. What impact, what role does it play?
So really, none. As you know, as socialist-minded people, we recognize that Trump is a symptom of capitalism, is not the problem. And to treat Trump like the problem is to essentially whitewash the history of the United States and whitewash the legacies of the presidents before him, including President Obama, all of which have been war criminals. You know, President Obama bombed multiple countries, had the most deportations in his career. Trump, to us, is no different from Obama or Bush or Clinton or any of them. The only thing that I say, really, in regard to the Trump presidency in Israel that is significant is that it shows Israel's consistency in siding with far-right extremism and fascism, which, ironically, endangers the Jewish community that it so claims to protect. And you can see this from, you know, Trump in the United States to Orban in Hungary. You know, during Netanyahu's presidency, or you know, like, not presidency, but during Netanyahu's reign, excuse me, before then and after then, Israel will continuously side with these far-right forces, which are, in my opinion, you know, fascism is and has been the number one threat to, like, world safety and world peace for a very long time. But in doing so, you know, Israel attempts to create this mirage that, you know, Arab violence is, like, the worst thing in the world, you know, Islamic extremism, when really Israel is, with the United States, funding Islamic reactionaries such as al-Qaeda factions in Syria, and has said that, you know, they would rather have an al-Qaeda presence than a Syrian presence in the region because it helps them contain their control over the Golan, and it helps them contain their, you know, their occupation. So I think really only the thing with the Trump presidency is that it shows Israel's continued support for conservatism, for far-right extremism, for fascism, in a way that's just totally open to the public.
Let's also not forget that it was Obama that gifted Israel a $38 billion military package over the next 10 years. Just quickly, it was never about the president. We could still have an Obama right now. Literally, nothing would be different. So it was never about the president. It was never about the person. It's just the entire inherently imperialistic and capitalistic system.
Well, we see we're almost out of time. Do you work at all with J Street? Are you familiar with J Street?
I'm familiar with J Street. Okay. No. I'm not sure as of recent, but the last time that I checked in with J Street, they were pro two-state solution. So there's that.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. I was going to want to organize with them actually last year, but when I looked them up, yeah, they had very problematic politics and nothing that we align with as Palestinians.
Right. Well, in this last minute or so, before we close, can you share with us contact information and any forthcoming events or lectures or rallies in 40 seconds?
We have Cody O'Rourke that's coming. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/...
FSU Students for Justice in Palestine is our Facebook.
Okay.
We have an active Twitter.
Our Twitter is FSU4SJP.
And we have a Juneteenth celebration coming up at the plant, organized by local black artists. And do you know what Juneteenth is? Should we go into that? Or, or just say, we'll see you on Saturday the 16th?
That's That's good. We are out of time. So time out for this edition of 411 Teen. To my listening audience, thanks for the privilege of your ear and your time. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Teen archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.